great writer Auberach once said, "Music washes away from the soul the dust of everyday life." And this conversation is really about those ideas that help us to transcend those everyday vexations of life. Music, friendship, the common interest and aspirations that we have for institutions that provide stability and undergird our society. I was asked to introduce this evening, give some context, and to introduce to justice. There are some of us who need introductions. And then there are those like Prince, the Queen, the Pope, Albright, and the notorious RBG. That need no introduction. So I will not introduce you, but if I may, I would like to share one or two very brief reflections. It was at a dinner party in 2003 of a new friend and neighbor in Georgetown that I was invited to dinner. I am now convinced that I was invited to fill in an empty seat. The Scalias, the Ginsburgs, and the O'Connors were there that evening. I was seated next to Professor Marty Ginsburg, and with very little to talk about, except the Goldberg Variations and Glenn Gould's recording, we struck up a beautiful friendship that has lasted for a very long time, inspired by music, that stuff that washes away the dust of everyday life. The Goldberg Variations was and is a wonderful metaphor for that relationship and the journey that we've experienced, because the Goldberg Variations reminds us that amidst all of this, what is perceived as chaos is this underlying order that gives meaning. And it begins with an aria, and at the very end, it's a variation on that. In December of 2016, Walter and I and some colleagues started to conspire about a special convening during Ideas Festival with Kitty. And it was to invite that wonderful odd couple of the Supreme Court to come here to the Aspen Institute to talk about the things that Walter will talk about with Justice Ginsburg today. Friendship, music, ideas, and a regard for institutions. Justice Ginsburg and Scalia were on a trip in India, and Justice Scalia was photographed in the front, sitting on the elephant, and behind him was Justice Ginsburg. A reporter asked, feministly, "Why were you sitting behind him?" And her reply was, "It's about the distribution of weight." The Aspen Institute is not a safe place. It's the place where we come together to agree to disagree and to work to find common ground for the things that are most important in society. For a very long time, our guest has been carrying a very heavy weight, fighting very important issues for women and for minorities and those who are voiceless. In A Man for All Seasons, there's this wonderful moment where Paul Scofield turns to his daughter Margaret, and she shares with him that the king has just made a decree. And he turns to her and he says, "But what is a decree, Margaret?" And he says, "It doesn't matter. It's the intent." And Thomas More turns and replies, "No, it's all about the words. Every word matters. When God made the angels, he made them to show him splendor and plants for their innocence and animals for their simplicity. But man he made to serve him wittily in the tingle of his mind. Thank you for serving us in the tingle of your mind so faithfully. Your Honor, it's a pleasure to have you here."
I was asked to talk to you about my dear colleague, Justice Antonin Scalia. And I'm going to read to you the introduction I wrote for a book that two of Justice Scalia's sons and a former law clerk put together. This book will be out in October. I first met Antonin Scalia when he served on the faculty of the University of Chicago's Law School. He was in Washington, D.C. to deliver a lecture on an issue generating controversy among scholars of administrative law, a field in which then Professor Scalia was a widely recognized leader. I disagreed in considerable part with the substance of his presentation, but his acumen, affability, and high spirits captivated me. When Professor Scalia was appointed to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit in 1982, the court on which I had served since 1980, I joined my colleagues in welcoming him with delight. He brought his large family to the immediate pre-formal investiture oath-taking, a ceremony needed to place him on the federal judiciary's payroll. I recall being uncertain whether Maureen Scalia was his wife or his eldest daughter. He and his partner in life, well, he held Maureen in the highest esteem. He often referred to her as Maureen the Beautiful. A 1960 Radcliffe graduate, Maureen was super smart. Also, master of the arts of raising children, 9 of them, managing social calendars, sewing haute couture clothes, and gourmet cooking. She and my husband, Supreme Chef Marty Ginsburg, were the most popular co-caterers at the Supreme Court spouses' quarterly gatherings for lunch in the Notley Cornell Rehnquist dining room, until the addition of two male spouses, it was the ladies' dining room. And my friendship with Justice Scalia was regarded by some as puzzling, because we followed distinctly different approaches to the interpretation of legal texts. But in our years together on the D.C. Circuit, there was nothing at all strange about our fondness for each other. Best friend of our then Chief Judge, J. Skelly Wright. His best friend was Circuit Judge Edward A. Tam. Wright had served as a federal district court judge in New Orleans, endeavoring against massive resistance to enforce desegregation in education and public transportation. Ed Tam had been second in command to J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI. Wright was a registered Democrat, Tam a registered Republican. Yet the two were so close, they even shopped for clothes together. So it did not seem unusual that my closest D.C. Circuit colleagues were Carter appointee Harry Edwards and Reagan appointees Robert Bork and Antonin Scalia. Justice Scalia was known for opinions of uncommon clarity and inimitable style, writings that did not disguise his view of the opposing position. Yet, as he put it, He attacked ideas, not people. He was a well-schooled grammarian. Now and then he would call me or stop by Chambers to point out a slip I had made in an opinion draft. He did this resisting circulation of a memorandum, copies to the other justices, which is the way we usually communicate with each other. He thought that might embarrass me, so he spoke to me face to face. And when we disagreed, which was not uncommon, my final opinion was always clearer and more convincing than my initial circulation. Justice Scalia homed in on all the soft spots, energizing me to strengthen my presentation. Unlike my dear colleague, Elena Kagan, I never sought to join Justice Scalia on his hunting adventures. But we several times traveled abroad together for exchanges with judges and lawyers in other lands. Eric Motley mentioned the famous India trip. Well, during that visit in 1994, I learned of an unusual talent Justice Scalia possessed. On a day when we were free from judicial interchanges, our driver took us to his friend's carpet shop in Agra. One rug after another was tossed onto the floor, leaving me without a clue which to choose. Justice Scalia pointed to one he thought just right for their beach house in North Carolina. He thought Maureen would like it. I immediately picked the same design in a different color. It has worn very well. We shared a passion for opera and were twice supernumeraries, extras, at the Washington National Opera. Talented composer, librettist, pianist, and lawyer Derek Wang wrote a comic opera titled Scalia Ginsburg, which, by the way, Scalia comes first because everything at the court is done in seniority order. And while Scalia Ginsburg has been performed in full or in part in various venues, in his preface to the publication of the libretto, Justice Scalia described as a high point in his life the spring of 2009. An evening at the Washington National Opera's ball held at the British ambassador's residence. In an elegant, spacious room, Justice Scalia joined two professional tenors at the piano for a medley of songs. He called it the famous Three Tenors performance. Both on and off the bench, Justice Scalia was a convivial, exuberant performer. Most of all, I prized the rare talent Justice Scalia possessed for making even the most sober judge smile. When we sat side by side on the D.C. Circuit, the panel was three judges, I occasionally pinched myself very hard to avoid uncontrollable laughter in response to one of his quips. On the Supreme Court, when we were separated by a few seats, notes he sent my way elicited a similar response. The collection, soon to be published, captures the mind, heart, and faith of a justice who has left an indelible stamp on the Supreme Court's jurisprudence and on the teaching and practice of law. The work of his fine hand will both inspire and challenge legions of judges and advocates. If our friendship encourages others to appreciate that some very good people have ideas with which we disagree, and that despite differences, people of goodwill can pull together for the well-being of the institutions we serve and our country, I will be overjoyed, and I am confident Justice Scalia would be too.
Thank you, Bonnie and Tom McCluskey, for sponsoring this. I want to thank you very much, Justice Ginsburg, for what was an incredibly important message, not only delightful reminiscences, but in this summer of our discontent, to remind us that civil discourse and respect for each other can come across ideological lines, something I think we've sometimes forgotten. So thank you very much.
That is the theme, by the way, of Scalia Ginsburg, the comic opera that will be performed next in Cooperstown, New York, on August 13th. The opera is roughly based on the magic flute. Justice Scalia is locked in a dark room. Mm. He is being punished for excessive dissenting. We are introduced in separate arias, so he sings, "The justices are blind. How can they possibly spout this? The Constitution says absolutely nothing about this." And then I answer him that he is searching for bright line solutions to problems that don't have easy answers. But the great thing about our Constitution is that, like our society, it can evolve. Anyway, so we go back to Scalia in the dark room. I enter through a glass ceiling. And I tell a character left over from Don Giovanni, the commentatore, that I am there to help Justice Scalia pass the tests. The commentatore said, "I don't understand this. He is your enemy. Why would you want to help him?" And then I say, "He's not my enemy. He's my friend." And then we break into a duet that's titled, "We Are Different, We Are One." Different in our approach to the interpretation of legal texts, but one in our reverence for the institution we serve and for the Constitution of the United States.
Well done.
And he loved that. I know he never got to see the full opera perform, but the "We Are Different, We Are One," which is sort of the theme of our nation, he liked that part two of the opera, right?
Yes, he did. He heard excerpts several times. It had its world premiere in Castleton, Virginia. It was Lauren Mazel's music festival. It was the very year that Lauren Mazel died. But Scalia was off in Europe teaching, so he couldn't attend that performance.
the theme of the opera is he is very much of a textualist originalist. You've often been called a minimalist in that you do not want to do very sweeping judgments, but you believe that the text evolves. Let's play that out, if you would, on perhaps a phrase like cruel and unusual punishment, where you've been on different sides of the death penalty issue.
Scalia would tell you that capital punishment is right there in the Constitution. So, obviously, the framers of the Bill of Rights contemplated a death penalty. And my answer to that is, have you ever visited the jail that's maintained in Williamsburg, Virginia? There you will find various instruments, if not torture, then the stock, things made to embarrass, humiliate people. 20 lashes, would we put up with that today? Surely the answer would be, that's cruel and unusual. So that clause, like the equal protection of the laws, grows with society. Things that were once considered permissible, we have grown to appreciate, are not permissible because they're out of tune with the current society and its mores.
And how did he refute that? How did he say we should just not interpret cruel and unusual in light of an evolving standard of what is cruel?
Well, he called it originalism faute de mieux. That is, he thought that if we didn't strictly follow the text, then the judge would be making it up. So to avoid that, he interpreted the Constitution laws literally. I take my cue from the opening of our Constitution. It's we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. The original Constitution was written in 1787. Who were we, the people? Who counted? And the answer is evident. Only white males who owned property. So I see the genius of this Constitution is that over the course of well over two sometimes turbulent centuries, we the people has become ever more inclusive. Left out in the beginning were people held in human bondage, Native Americans didn't have the franchise. And of course, half the population, the women. But I think when the 14th Amendment was added to the Constitution in 1868, those framers envisioned that it would have growth potential. If you had asked any of the framers, what does this mean? That women are persons of equal citizenship stature. They would have answered, no. Many states didn't yet have married women property acts. So women who were married couldn't contract in their own name, couldn't sue and be sued in their own name, couldn't hold property in their own name. There was no immediate attempt to change that. But how could one think of an equal protection norm that leaves out half the population?
On that point, one of your famous disagreements was on VMI, the Virginia Military Institute, in which they were not accepting women, and you made pretty much the point you just made there, that that was denial of equal protection. And he wrote a scathing dissent attacking you. But the most interesting little thing I learned is that before he circulated it, he walked by your chambers and gave it to you early so you could prepare your own decision and refute him.
I had circulated my opinion. The clock was ticking. At the court, we have no backlog, so everything that comes in the first Monday in October must be out before we leave town in June. So getting into the early days of June, Justice Scalia came to my chambers. He threw down a sheaf of paper, and he said, "Ruth, this is my penultimate draft of the VMI dissent. I'm not yet prepared to circulate to the court, but I want to give you as much time as I can to answer it."
And what did you have to answer or change based on him?
Many. The final VMI opinion is very strong, but it is so because of the strength of the Scalia dissent. He descended to a level that I thought should be kept out. A footnote that said, "We must excuse this opinion author who knows about the State University in New York." But she referred to the University of Virginia at Charlottesville. There is no University of Virginia at Charlottesville. There is only the University of Virginia. So how did I fix it up? I put the, in quotes, "the University of Virginia at Charlottesville," and I quoted an excellent federal district judge in the Eastern District of Virginia, Judge Marriage. Didn't make any difference. Scalia kept the remark in about the justice who knows about places like SUNY in New York.
But to push you on the substance, we're in the, he says, "We're in the Constitution. Do you find that VMI has to admit women?" Where did you find it?
In the Equal Protection Clause. Which today surely must include half the population. The case has an interesting and revealing title. It was United States against Virginia. So it wasn't an individual woman who was suing to be admitted. It was the United States government saying to the state of Virginia, "You cannot make an opportunity available to members of one gender, but not the other." It wasn't all that long ago that the University of Virginia at Charlottesville was all male. That didn't change until 1970.
You mentioned...
It was, I think, keenly disappointing to Justice Scalia that our then Chief Justice Rehnquist signed on to my judgment, not the opinion, but the judgment. So Scalia was the lone dissenter in that case.
I'm not sure it made him unhappy. He sort of liked that role sometimes, but...
I had a great experience in February when the commanding officer of VMI, General Pei, asked me to celebrate the 20th anniversary of that decision. I missed by 1 year, but I did get there. And to see how proud they are of the women cadets, women who expected to grow up to become engineers, nuclear scientists. They didn't change the Spartan living, although they did make a concession. The very first year women were admitted, the school said, we will treat them just like the men. No special dispensation. So the women will have to have their heads shaved, just like the male cadets. Well, they got over that.
Okay. I'm glad that didn't have to come to the court. You mentioned a moment ago cruel and unusual, evolving standards, how you at least, as opposed to him, would interpret it differently each decade or each century as we evolve. I happen to be at a memorable scene. I don't know if you'll remember it, but every now and then, because I'm such a geek, I actually go to the Supreme Court and just sit in the back and listen to the arguments. And it was on juvenile death penalty. And you leaned forward at one point to ask whether, you know, it was a question of whether juveniles could be put to death. And you asked something about international law. And I felt like a volcano was erupting on the other side, because suddenly Justice Scalia started not so much jumping down your throat, because he had to address it to the poor lawyer who was trying to present the case, but he was responding to you by that. Do you remember that? And how did you all differ on international law?
My comment was that we were the only industrialized country in the world that administered the death penalty to juveniles. We have since had a follow-on case. Is it permissible, consistent with the cruel and unusual punishment clause, to sentence a juvenile to prison without the possibility of parole, that is, a life sentence? And as you mentioned, the court tends to not take giant steps, move one step at a time. So after the court held that the death penalty for juveniles was unconstitutional, and we had lots of scientific evidence about the state of maturity of adolescents. So after that precedent, then the court held the hopeless sentence of life without the possibility of parole is also unconstitutional. We, by the way, in the last several years, the actual executions carried out in the United States has gone down and down. So now there are only 6 states that in fact administer the death penalty. And in those 6 states, it's particular counties. So you might have a district attorney in one county that seeks the death penalty, and in another county refuses to ask for the death penalty.
That's interesting, because what that is a very difficult issue working its way not just to be decided by the Supreme Court, but working its way through the democratic process, through legislatures and others making that decision. I know you and Justice Breyer at one point said that the Supreme Court should reconsider and perhaps strike down the death penalty. You were in the minority. And so it's become state by state, and it's begun to decline. I raise that because you said something extraordinarily interesting about Roe v. Wade, which is, though obviously, or I should assume obviously, you felt that women should have a right to choose. You felt that Roe v. Wade had a downside to it because it stopped that issue from marching through the legislative process, and it should have been decided perhaps that way. Am I correct?
It should have been, the judgment should have been the same. Texas had the most extreme law in the nation. A woman did not have access to abortion unless it was necessary to save her life. Didn't matter that she might end up being debilitated. There were several women who had taken thalidomide and feared having a deformed fetus. whose chances of survival would not be good. And none of that counted in Texas. It had to be necessary to save the woman's life. So my view was the court should have put down its pen declaring that law unconstitutional and then wait for the next case and the next case to carry the principle.
As opposed to the sweeping decision outlawing all abortion.
Because the decision made every abortion law in the country, even the most liberal, unconstitutional in one fell swoop. It gave the right to life people a new target to aim at, a single target. The unelected justices of the Supreme Court have decided this question for the nation, taking it out of the political process. To this day, on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the case was decided in 1973, there is a march. Many school children released from school to participate. But there was a target that was easy to hit.
And so that's why you're in favor of a more minimalist approach when it's not necessary to do a sweeping judgment.
I thought the court should have dealt with the law that was before them, the Texas law. Then it could go on to another case where the state imposed severe restrictions. It could have done what the court usually does, think of Brown v. Board of Education. Many times Thurgood Marshall appeared before the court and said, separate but equal is not before the court today. These facilities are anything but equal. Then when he had his building blocks in place, including the University of Texas, that when the state was given to understand you must give minority students an opportunity for a legal education, they didn't admit minorities to the University of Texas. They set up a separate law school, vastly inferior. So there was that. And then there was another case of a state that said, we'll pay the tuition of any African American to go to a school in another state, but we're not going to provide. Or we will put this student, isolate him in the back corner of the room. All those precedents were in place, and then Marshall could say to the court in Brown v. Board, separate, state-enforced separation of the races is never constitutional.
That's when Thurgood Marshall was a lawyer appearing before the court, before he was a justice. Let me ask you, based on that analysis, I'm going to give you a comparable case. Gay marriage. Would it have been possible to do a step-by-step approach instead of the sweeping decision on gay marriage? And would that have been perhaps preferable given the political process?
Well, it was step-by-step. The case of Lawrence v. Texas started it all. Texas made same-sex relations a crime. Consensual sodomy was a crime. The court first decided that consensual activity between adults was none of the state's business. That was step one. And then in Colorado, there was an ordinance passed that said, in our anti-discrimination laws, anti-discrimination on the basis of race, religion, national origin, gender, we will not include same-sex relations. That meant that gay activists had a a hurdle to cross that no other group did. No other group had to fight to be included in anti-discrimination laws. So the court held that unconstitutional. And then there was Congress's reaction in the so-called case, Defense of Marriage Act case, saying, for all purposes, the federal government will not recognize same-sex marriage. So you couldn't file a joint return with your life's partner. Or you couldn't get Social Security benefits from if your spouse was a covered worker. So Obergefell was the fourth time. And in the meantime, a number of states had changed. So in my home state of New York, same-sex marriage was recognized. The handwriting was on the wall. It was a little bit like in Nevada in the not-so-good old days when you could go to Nevada to get a divorce on consent. She stayed there for 6 weeks. Other states began to think, why should Nevada have a monopoly on that business? And inside of a 10-year period, no-fault divorce took the country by storm.
To bring us back to Scalia, that was one of his most vibrant dissents on same-sex marriage, right? Did you discuss it with him? Did you all have any colloquy? Did it sharpen your opinion? And what did you think of his approach to it? Because it was basically an originalist approach, not just that he was anti-gay. It was, where in the Constitution do you find this?
Yes. There was no room for discussion on that issue. You mentioned in one of the cases on the way to Obergefell, Justice Kennedy, who, by the way, wrote all four opinions on same-sex relations, he had referred to a lead opinion from the early 1980s by the European Court of Human Rights under the European Convention on Human Rights. And he was roundly criticized. But he was making the same point. This is where the rest of the world, countries that adhere to our values, this is where they are. How far behind can the United States Supreme Court be?
You famously made your legal early career, part of it was on gender discrimination cases. When you got out of law school, is it true that Felix Frankfurter would not hire you because you were a woman?
Is it true? Yes, but he wasn't alone. there was only one woman ever hired as a law clerk before 1968. And that woman was Lucille Lohman. She was engaged by Justice Douglas. Justice Douglas always took his clerks from the recommendation of the West Coast Law School deans. They wrote to him one year, sorry, but we have no one qualified to be your law clerk. And he wrote back saying, when you say you have no one qualified, have you considered women? If you have one who is absolutely top-notch, I will hire her. Well, he did hire her. She worked out very well. There was not another woman law clerk until 1968. When Justice Black hired Margaret Corcoran. Now, some say that she had a special in with the justice because her father was a well-known Democratic.
Tommy the Court Corcoran, right. Yeah.
And one weekend, he sent, Justice Black sent Margaret home to go through 100 cert petitions. And she came back on Monday and said, I'm sorry, I couldn't finish the job. And my father had to appear at a number of Democratic Party fundraisers. He was a widower, so he took me along. Justice Black was not pleased with that answer. But it wasn't until 1972 that women began to show up in numbers. Professor Al Sachs, who was my teacher at Harvard, picked Frankfurt as clerks. And when he recommended me, Frankfurter first asked, does she wear skirts? I can't abide women in pants. If you want her to wear a skirt, she will wear it. Eventually, Justice Frankfurter decided he was not prepared to engage a woman. This was in, I had a federal district court clerkship, so this would have been in 1960.
Speaking of that long history of that type of discrimination, one of your most influential dissents was in the Lilly Ledbetter case, where they said she hadn't raised the issue soon enough, statute of limitations had run out. And I think in your dissent, you ended up telling them what to do.
I ended up telling Congress what to do. The tagline of the Lilly Ledbetter dissent was, the ball is now in Congress's court to correct the error into which my colleagues have fallen. And inside of 2 years, with large majorities, Republican, Democrat, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act was adopted. I think there is a photograph of President Obama signing that act. It was the first full piece of legislation he signed when he took office. And I believe that Madeleine Albright is in that photograph. With,
is that right?
You are? Okay, good.
And Hillary Clinton was in it, Eleanor Holmes Norton, Olympia Snow. Well, I had seen this once before in my lawyering days when the Supreme Court decided twice in the 1970s that discrimination on the basis of pregnancy was not discrimination on the basis of sex. Because the world was divided into two classes of people. There were pregnant people and non-pregnant people. And many women were in the non-pregnant. So how could it be gender-based discrimination? There was a coalition formed to change that, and Congress passed the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, amending Title VII, it's our principal anti-discrimination in employment law. And that act was the soul of simplicity. It simply said discrimination on the basis of pregnancy is discrimination on the basis of gender.
The most important case, I think, that you're going to have next term, which obviously you can't talk about how you're going to decide, is gerrymandering.
Partisan gerrymandering.
Yeah. And on what principles is it being argued, and are you wrestling with it?
Well, this case will be argued in the coming term. We have had a great number of cases where districts were rigged so that either they would pack all the African Americans into one district or disperse them. The idea was to dilute their voting strength. So the coroner has been comfortable dealing with racial gerrymanders. So far, it has resisted the argument that the legislature, whether Democrat or Republican, has drawn the district lines so that the party in power will get the majority of seats in the legislature, even if we took a poll of all the citizens, the other party would prevail. So this is a three-judge federal district court held Wisconsin's, the districting lines drawn by Wisconsin's Republican legislature, unconstitutional. And it's a game both sides have played when the Democrats were in control of the state legislature. They fixed the district lines so the Democrats would have an advantage. And now it's the Republicans in control. What many people have urged on the court is it's a threat to our democracy, that people who are in districts that have been rigged for one party or the other will say, why bother voting? The outcome is preordained. We are in a Republican district or a Democratic district.
It would seem that that would be a nonpartisan question of law, and it has been over the years. Republicans have been in favor of getting rid of bad gerrymandering, too. Do you think this will become a partisan issue? And how do we prevent constitutional issues from being decided on party basis?
There are already not experiments, but other systems underway. California and Arizona have taken the redistricting job away from the state legislatures and given it to a nonpartisan commission to draw the district lines. That was challenged as unconstitutional because the Constitution says that the state legislatures will draw the state district lines. I took the position for the majority. Justice Scalia was on the other side. So what does state legislature mean? It's who has the political authority over this question. And if a state chooses to have a ballot initiative where the people, in effect, pass laws, then the people are the legislature for that purpose. And that was a lopsided majority opinion.
Let me open it up. If there are mic runners? Yeah, okay. There's probably a couple of questions, I think. Yeah. Is that a hand or a mic? Okay, grab the mic then.
Hi, I preside over the geographic highest court in the land over in Leadville. And at State Judicial Conference, we've had a number of presentations about the failure of the judiciary in World War II Germany. At a time where there's really some question whether the chief executive denigrates the institution, what is the role of the judge of the judiciary to speak up, to embrace, and to celebrate the reverence that you and Justice Scalia share and celebrate of the court?
Judges can't defend their opinions. They can only say, read my opinion. But we do rely on the bar, on practicing lawyers to remind the public what a precious thing judicial independence is. And it really is the hallmark and pride of the United States. We are the envy of the world in that respect. You can think of some famous cases. Think of the Steele seizure case. when the workers were about to go on strike, President Truman thought that that was dangerous for our war effort in Korea. So we had the government take over the steel mills. That was challenged by the mill owners, and the court held, President, you don't have that authority to act alone. To do what your executive order commands, you must have legislation. It's not your decision. It's you in combination with Congress. What did President Truman do? He told his Secretary of Commerce, give back the mills to the owner. And that happened immediately. Or most dramatically in my lifetime, it wasn't even a Supreme Court decision. It was Judge Sirica, a district judge in the District of Columbia, who was presiding over a burglary case. The burglary occurred at the Democratic National Committee's headquarters. And Judge Sirica sent a subpoena saying every person is obliged to give relevant evidence in court and the tapes that you have made of conversations in the Oval Office are needed for this criminal prosecution. You must turn them over. Nixon turned over the tapes, and the next day he resigned from office. The court lacks the power of the purse. We don't have any independent resources at our command. We don't have troops that we can call out. There are so many incidents in our country where the executive has accepted that the judges have the last word. Think of Governor Orville Faubus in Arkansas when he blocked the door of Central High School and said no African-American child will ever cross the threshold of this school. It's not altogether clear whether President Eisenhower was an enthusiast about desegregation, but he called out the troops, and there's a picture on the front page of the New York Times, the troops on both sides, and this thin line of black children going through the entrance. So, I'd say right now, people may be down on the way our system is not working, but of all three branches, the judiciary comes out way ahead of me.
What a high bar, but... Great. Further question? Okay, way in the back there, I think. I'm sorry, there's a hand of a woman, is it? Yeah.
Thank you for being here. I had a question. If you and Scalia ever talked about Citizens United outside of the chamber, and if this ruling has had more or less of an effect than you thought it might?
Good question.
I think it has exactly the effect that was predicted by the dissenting opinion, which I joined. So it will remain to be seen whether that decision has staying power.
I'm sorry, by that do you mean either Congress changes the law, or I don't know that that would overcome the constitutional issue, or is there a constitutional amendment, or does the Supreme Court reconsider?
It's two ways. Constitutional amendments are powerfully hard to pass in the United States. I know that from the years I was in the trenches urging ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, which failed by 3 states. The court will have a chance to reconsider, because there will be states that will pass campaign restriction laws, and those will be tested and eventually make their way to the Supreme Court, giving the court an opportunity to rethink its decision. We have a great history in our country of dissenting opinions in time becoming the law of the land. Take the worst case the Supreme Court ever decided, the Dred Scott case. There were 2 dissents in that case. And Scalia once said that when the court gets it wrong, really wrong, it's comforting to look back and see that there were justices who pointed out how wrong the court's decision was. Many places in the world, there are no dissenting opinions. A court's judgment will come out as the judgment of the court. It will be faceless. You don't know who wrote the judgment. You don't know whether there was disagreement. In many places, including the European Union and the European Court of Justice, they don't allow dissents because their notion is we must make it appear that the law is clear and certain. The people shouldn't think that the law is instable. I've had many discussions with continental jurists and say, there must be many decisions where you were divided. Oh, yes. They freely admit that. But they think it's dangerous to let the public know that there's more than one way, more than one reasonable way of reading a law.
Does that mean that the most scathing dissents of your close friend, Justice Scalia, were welcomed by you? And do you think they will have an impact?
And there is a book that came out in the spring called the title is something like The Liberal Opinions of Justice Scalia. And in many areas, he has been ahead of the pack in search and seizure cases. He has given a dynamic interpretation to the Fourth Amendment. The first time he did that was a case involving helicopters flying over the roofs of houses if the heat emanations were stronger than one might expect, chances are that the homeowner was growing marijuana. So the helicopter never touched down on the house. But Justice Scalia said that is incompatible with unreasonable searches and seizure. He also agreed that the police need a warrant to examine a cell phone. So in that area and in another, the right of a criminal defendant to be confronted by the witnesses against him, Scalia has been.
On those unreasonable search and seizures, if he's such an originalist, how does he figure out how it applies to GPS systems, cell phone records by the phone companies? That would seem you would need a evolving interpretation.
Well, he thinks that the clause itself calls for an evolving interpretation because it says unreasonable.
Okay. Finally, I think after Bush v. Gore, when you were of course very much on different sides, it was a very tough day. I think everybody was very tired at the end. And late that evening, you got a phone call from him.
Yeah. It was an endurance contest. And the government and the opposing parties filed their briefs on... We granted review on Saturday. The briefs were filed on Sunday. We heard oral argument on Monday, and then the opinions were out by Tuesday. The press was vastly confused. They first reported that the decision was 7-2, but in fact it was 5-4. They misread where Justice Breyer and Justice Souter were. Well, it was a trying day. I had a call from Justice Scalia about 9 o'clock that night. Justice Scalia said, "Ruth, what are you doing still at the court? You should go home and take a hot bath." Which I did. One of his favorite expressions was, "Get over it."
And real quickly, I just want to mention that this is not your first time at the Aspen Institute. In fact, you've been here recently. But also, you were here 35 years ago for the Justice and Society seminar that Justice Blackmun and others took. It's one of the original seminars of the Aspen Institute. How did that affect you? And I think it affected Justice Blackmun as well.
There was a very good set of materials put together by an NYU law professor. The conversations were stimulating. We took great advantage of the music festival, often sitting outside on blankets listening to the rehearsals. I mentioned in some... In fact, I mentioned to the people in the other room that our discussion, one of our two discussion leaders, Shirley Mount Hofstetter, would have been Jimmy Carter's pick for the U.S. Supreme Court if there had been a vacancy in his term. He did a remarkable thing. He changed the complexion of the U.S. judiciary. He looked around at the federal judges and said, "You know, they all look like me. That is, they are white men of means. But that's not how the great United States looks." So he was determined to put women on the bench, members of minority groups, not as one-at-a-time curiosities, but in numbers. So at the beginning of Carter's term, Shirley Hofstetter was a Court of Appeals judge on the Ninth Circuit, the only woman on a federal Court of Appeals. He made her the first ever Secretary of Education, and then there were none again. He nominated over 25 women to federal trial courts, and I was one of the lucky 11 that he appointed to Circuit Court of Appeals.
And finally, to leave us here, since you've talked about books, the book that you did on Justice Scalia is out this fall. Eric Motley has a book out this fall. I have a book out this fall. Secretary Clinton has a book out this fall. I think, though, that the book that's going to blow us all away and leave us in the dust is something called the Notorious RBG Workout, which your trainer is writing about the workout he puts you through every evening. I kind of want to know what that is, and also, with all due respect to Justice Scalia, could you have taken him down if you needed to?
Well, we have a gym downstairs. It's only for the justices. If another justice is there, I usually wait and come later. But, you know, it never bothered him if I was there at the same time. He was. We began working together in 1999. It was the year I had colorectal cancer. So I had massive surgery and 9 months of chemotherapy, 6 weeks of everyday radiation. And by the time I was finished with all that, my husband said, "You look like a survivor of Auschwitz. You must do something to build yourself up." And then I asked around, and Gladys Kessler, who was a district judge, said, "We have someone in the district court. He works in the clerk's office when he's not training people. He trains a number of the judges in the U.S. courthouse. We think he would be just right for you." And now he trains Justice Kagan. When she gets over her foot injury, she'll go back to him. And Justice Breyer, his latest training. This whole routine has been filmed. The book is very well illustrated. When I get back, waiting for me will be the page proofs. And I have an August 8th date to approve it.
Well, we'll see you on book tour. And thank you so very much for an inspiring evening.